Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actress Frida Pinto. Growing up in India, Frida Pinto always knew she would act in films. She just didn't know her first one would be Slumdog Millionaire, one of the most successful and acclaimed films of all time. She quickly became a muse for directors that most actors wait decades to work with. She wanted to be more. Most beautiful women find themselves in that position in Hollywood, but few are as honest about it. I had an amazing talk with Frida about being a complete novice on Slumdog and what she had to do from there to build the career she wanted. And it wasn't always easy. She had to battle expectations from Hollywood and sometimes take roles that didn't utilize all her talents. It also meant sitting idle and turning down projects while she waited for the right opportunity. Her work on Showtime's Guerrilla proves it was worth the struggle. In this episode, Frida shares what she's learned from iconic directors such as Terrence Malick, Woody Allen, Michael Winterbottom, and Danny Boyle, not David Boyle. She also talks about her Bollywood inspirations and why you should not ask her to play a princess, a bear or a Teletubby maybe, but never a princess. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Frida.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
You know, I like probably everybody else in the world, became aware of you on the same day when they saw Slumdog Millionaire. And you really had one of those stories where, you know, sort of like an overnight coming out party to the whole world, which is fascinating, and I want to talk about that. But to have a career that's very hard to pigeonhole is, I mean, it's the reason I wanted to have you on here, because I think that you've carved out a career that I have no idea what you'll do next based on what you did last.
Oh, thank you.
You know, and I think that's hard to do. And it's especially hard to do when everything happens at once. But I want to jump right into your new television series called Guerrilla.
Yes.
This is a fascinating show because, especially in light of what's changed in both the UK and the United States over the last 3 or 4 months in terms of nationalism and in terms of the way that we're now looking at immigrants again, that we haven't really had to face in either country since the 60s and 70s. And in this case, it's a show about, I mean, I like to think of it in a weird way as akin to Breaking Bad in the sense that you play a character that that starts, like all of us, with a conscience, as someone who's trying to make a life for herself and feels strongly about political things and thinks peaceful protest is the way you do it.
Absolutely.
And a series of events makes you sort of nihilistic in your belief that a social peaceful protest can help. And you turn radically militant over the course of this series, which, you know, is a lot more believable when you think about the political climate of this world in the last few months, right?
Actually, and it's actually true of any revolution. You know, we went back to when before we started shooting the show, we went back to many other revolutions, so not just the 1970s, because this is based in, obviously, 1971 England, around the Immigration Act, 1971 Immigration Act. But to kind of also understand, because I'm playing a revolutionary at the end of the day, so I wanted to research other revolutionaries, so...
Did you go to Hamilton?
No, I didn't. I wish I did, though.
I know.
Because someone else actually suggested, I was like, did you? Oh, no. But just learning about other revolutionaries and other revolutions that really grabbed eyeballs across the world. And a lot of it, including India, all started on a very peaceful note and all about nonviolence. Gandhi... did the whole non-cooperation civil disobedience movements. And then what happens is there's always a faction of society that go, but what are we really achieving out of this? Are people really paying attention? And then you have that split that happens with radicalism.
Right.
So the moderates and radicalism exist in any revolution, including in Guerrilla. We have the moderates, which I think Marcus's character is more of a wanting
to be... Your boyfriend on the show.
My boyfriend, yeah. Wanting to be more of a moderate, whereas I turn a little more radical.
Which is a surprise. I would think that you'd get a script like that, and the first thing that would cross your mind would be, why aren't there more roles for women like this?
Oh, absolutely. And why aren't there more roles for women of my color, and my ethnicity for you know, written like this.
Especially given the history.
Especially given the history with the UK, especially given the richness of stories that actually comes out of India, especially given the fact that even if you don't go back into history and you just look at what's happening in the world today, we're just a global population, you know, there is no black and white and other colors of the skin. And we look at America and you think about who built this land and its immigrants and people who came from all different parts of the world. You think about some of the best doctors in America right now, and they're all Indian. So there are stories about every race, every ethnicity at this current, in this current climate, everywhere in the world. And still, I don't know, there's just this need for segregation and separation, which baffles me that it exists sometimes even in my film industry.
Yeah.
And definitely when we go down, if you take ethnicity out of it, I look at just stories written for women. And I feel sometimes it's not just a woman of color who actually really struggles to find the right project. Of course she does. But it's white women who also struggle to find good, substantial, meaty, substantive roles, actually, is something that really is worth their time, their talent. I think it's across the board a real issue in Hollywood.
Well, when you got the project, what was your initial reaction to it? Like,
when I first read it, my first reaction was to A, be part of it, but B, did this really happen? Because I was like, I've never read about this.
Right, like, and I think what you're referring to is the London Police Force had a Black Power Desk, mm-hmm. and their whole directive, their mission was to
keep Black, I wouldn't say radicals, not but just any revolutionaries suppressed. And though it's based on certain political and historical facts, it's still a what-if drama. It's still a what-if the Black Power movement in 1971 England got radicalized. That is a what if. And he also ties in with what was happening in India with communism, the Communist Party. And that is actually my connection with radicalism as well, with revolution as well, my father. So all of that reveals itself in time.
Well, the parallels with now are I mean, I'm sure you must have, throughout the course of filming, there must have been some lines that landed particularly close to
absolutely
to what's going on now. I mean, did that enter in your mind in sort of a futile way that, oh my gosh, this kind of stuff happened 40 years ago?
Yeah, and history repeats itself.
Right.
Well, definitely. Interestingly, on two levels, specifically because I'm a woman and I play this amazing character, Jazz. On one level, it was definitely about politics and history and activism. And she's, like I said, she's politically really active. And there's this line that she has with Kent, played by Idris Elba, who plays my ex-lover in the series, where she says, they're changing the laws on us. One day people are going to ask us what we did. I'm not going to tell them I sat on a fence. And I feel that's exactly the kind of climate that we are experiencing right now, where neutrality almost isn't an option. You can't be not for one or the other, because
to be neutral is to be for the other.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Absolutely. Definitely at this point in time. And standing up for what you believe in, and standing up for what the truth is, and standing up for what people should have, which is equal rights and dignity, is almost something that you don't have an option now to say, I'll let someone else do the job. I feel everybody needs to have their voice heard at this point in time. And I think that has become really apparent with the Women's March, with people who never really expected America to have a massive change in its in history, especially with the Obamas leaving.
Or for Brexit to pass.
With what's happening in Syria even, you know, what's happening in other parts of the world. I think it's definitely become a time where, you know, people can't stay neutral.
Yeah.
Almost can't afford to stay neutral. And the second part of it, where the lines really resonate, is sexism, and misogyny, which exists and has existed for as long as I remember reading my history textbooks.
Sure.
Whether in a political struggle, whether in an entertainment industry like mine, it just exists. It exists. Even within families, it does exist. And so I think Jazz really has this other fight that is going on side by side, which is she's the only woman in this underground cell that has been formed, and she's constantly undermined for her ideas, for her activism, for the fact that she wants to do something. She's constantly undermined. In episode one, which I, you know, burst out laughing when I watched it on the big screen. They go to get a weapon, and and the guy, and she says, you know, I'm going to help. I'm going to help you with this. And he looks at her and says, what good are you? You know, what are you going to do? What are you capable of doing? Nothing. You know, it's like pretty much that to her face.
Yeah.
And she's got to stand there and watch her boyfriend and her other friend just stand there, not even stand up for her, but she's just being like insulted, you know, by a stranger. And that is something that we see time and again. I've had a bunch of female writers who are my friends who have told me that in a boardroom when they sit down and they discuss scripts, their ideas, because they're constantly dominated by more male writers in the boardroom, they're constantly undermined for even having an idea.
And I would wonder, when you see a script like this, if something gets sparked even from way back when you wanted to start acting, mm-hmm. where you go, oh, this is why I wanted to become an actor. I get
to be
a badass. I get to be...
I get to be human. I get to embrace all sides of my femininity, one of
right.
them being, you know, the softer, gentler side, which the whole world looks upon as weak, and then, you know, just uses that stereotype of the softer, gentler, kinder, compassionate, and there's, like, nothing else to it. And then there is the other stereotype, which is that of a sexy woman. You know, you can only be sexy because you're a woman and you're beautiful, whatever. So let's just appeal to the masses by playing off of your sex appeal. And then as you get older, you can only be a mother. So, you know, I obviously did not think that was what I was going to do as I, you know, like you were saying, I could see myself being a superhero even when I was 15, 16.
Right.
So I never saw myself as the sidekick or someone who did not have a voice. So when a character like this comes along, I say it to myself, I've waited 8 years for it. It came into this industry nine years ago. And Slumdog definitely was my, you know, my platform. And
sure.
I started off from there. But I wouldn't say that every role that I've picked after Slumdog was empowered and strong. And though I saw it as empowered and strong, what finally was put up on the screen was not definitely empowered and strong. And that mostly happens with the big budget films, not so much with the independent ones, because the independent ones are quite straightforward.
But I would think that if you decided to make that your criteria from right off the bat, you just wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Because the material wouldn't be there.
It's true. And which is why I had to do some that I was not completely sure whether it was right for me. Then I would discuss them with the director, saying, could we add a little more to it? And again, like I said, on the independent films, it was more straightforward. So whether it was playing Miral in the Julian Schnabel film, which was the second film that I did, was very clear to me that I was playing a defiant teenager.
Right.
And that's what it was going to be. It was a very strong role, so there was no two ways about it. Or even doing a film like Trishna with Michael Winterbottom,
yes.
where really her strength is not completely understood at first because she seems very submissive. And then slowly her inner strength starts bubbling up and comes to the surface.
Right.
But with the big budget films, I've struggled. I've definitely struggled. I've seen something on paper and it's not something that I finally watch on the big screen. But do I regret doing any of them? Absolutely not, because I'm glad I was part of those big budget films that actually gave me more visibility.
Sure.
But also made me really aware that I don't want to pick those kind of roles again in the future. And I think you need to do them to make some of those mistakes, especially when you don't have the option of not making the mistakes.
Right, right.
And then go, okay, I'm really glad this happened, but in the future, I can't see myself playing that role again. And listen, it's taken me 8 years to now be in a position where I can say no to things and not feel terrible about it. But when I'm just starting off my career, I don't want to be saying no to some films that could take me to the next level.
You know, it's funny because I think that in some ways you didn't get to have the career where you toiled in obscurity and
yeah.
made a few films where you could sort of push them aside.
No, I couldn't.
In the far reaches of the internet that, you know, you're the first time anyone sees you, you're in a film that wins Best Picture. That's
yeah.
crazy. Do you think you had an upbringing where your parents had a pretty good understanding of mm-hmm. the place you could end up?
Absolutely. I think the thing that has made me as independent as I am today, but also has given me this really strong sense of self, which is being self-made, rather, really comes from my parents. Because
really?
At home, what I would see was it wasn't about, like, we were not fighting about talking about equal rights or any of that, or feminism even, but it was in everyday life, where we didn't have to talk about it, we could just see it. For example, my dad would help my mom out in the kitchen. you know, and wasn't like one of those typical, stereotypical rather, Indian households where the men just wait for the food to be served by the woman and none of that. My dad cooked. My dad
really?
Cooked for us when my mom was a school teacher. So if my mom had training, teacher's training, or she had to go away for work, he cooked for us. So we would see that, you know, he would do the dishes. He would help us do the dishes. So there was a kind of equality already in the household, which we didn't have to specifically even talk about.
It was just there.
It was just there. Yeah. So it felt very natural. And I think it was the same with the kind of films that my dad made us watch. Again, I don't think it was, I definitely think it was something that he liked, which he made us watch, but I don't think it was necessarily and completely accidental, because I feel somewhere in there he also saw women in those, in that empowered sense of
right.
mind, you know, so he shared the same with us. So a lot of 80s films, late 80s, Indian films. There used to be something called the parallel cinema or art house cinema that existed back then. And then the 90s was this boom of extreme commercial cinema. So we were exposed to a lot of 80s, my sister and I, specifically these two female actors, Shabana Azmi and Smita Patil, who always played the badass women, you know, whether it was
interesting.
So I grew up being one of the biggest Smita Patil fans. I was like, I want to do, if I get into the film industry, I want to pick up roles like her in India. And then it was obviously Charlize Theron who did Monster, and I was like, sealing the deal, this is what I'm going to do for a living.
Monster sticks out for being a film made by one of those beautiful women in the world, and she goes through this transformation.
Mm-hmm.
So you're either going to look at that film and go, oh, that's not for me at all.
Yeah.
That's a characterization that doesn't fit with me. Or like you, you're going to look at it and say, that's what acting is. Like,
that's what acting is.
Yourself.
That's a challenge. That's what I like. I never saw myself as a princess, you know, as much as I loved Princess Diaries and all of those films. I never saw myself being in those princess roles. It was always gritty dramas. And you actually bring up a very good point. For me, the fact that an actor could dedicate themselves to letting themselves transform, giving them their body, their mind, their soul, permission to go into this extreme transformation and being kind to the transformation as well, you know, is very important. You have to be kind to the transformation. You've got to love that character. It's not necessarily the most savory character. People, and even in the movie, look down upon a character like hers. But the fact that she embraced it and loved it, for me, was what acting was all about.
There was almost a personal statement from her there.
Oh, absolutely.
Saying, I am tired of being.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Halle Berry, absolutely.
Same
Monsters
thing.
Ball, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we end up having to do to tell people to stop looking at me like the sex bomb or the princess or the sunshine girl. We have more. And that's what jazz is for me as well, you know? Like I said, waited 8 years to go, shut the fuck up and stop sending me sunshine roles. I am not sunshine. Stop
right.
sending me those roles. It was frustrating. So I didn't work for 2 years because I was like, I don't want to do these roles. They're just not for me.
So you went through a period where you just backed away from it.
Yeah, because I was constantly getting stuff that I did not want to be part of. I just looked at it as, well, luckily for me at that point in time, I had earned enough, so I was not living a hand-to-mouth existence. So I was in that privileged position. But as someone who had a certain set of expectations out of myself, I just felt like I wasn't being able to fulfill it by playing characters that I didn't feel were strong enough. And I haven't really played a lot of them. I've probably played two of them. But even just being given a script, or sent a script, where my character is totally being undermined or not even given, you know, substance, for me was kind of an insult to even read it. So I'm like, I'm not going to partake in any of this.
Did you ever question, like, whether or not you would keep going in the industry?
I didn't question that, but I did question if people could see me for more than what they were seeing me for. And I did question if I was going to be able to break that stereotype, because it wasn't sitting well with me and it was making me very frustrated and anxious.
There's so many examples of people that have been in your position that haven't risen above that limitation that, you know, agents or an audience or critics or whoever say, this is the lane they should stay in. And they
And they said that to me like quite early on as well with, I think it was Rise of the Planet of the Apes. There was this whole article that was run on, I remember that article so clearly because I cut it out and I sent it to my agent. And in the article, they mentioned Charlize Theron and Halle Berry, two of my favorite actresses. And they said, will Frida be able... Is it the rise and rise of Frida Pinto, or is it the rise and fall of Frida Pinto? Because, you know, playing on the word Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And I read the article and was really demoralizing. And I remember I was in New York in this high-rise hotel reading this, not like I'm saying that I was going to jump out of a window. And then when I read it, and I go, oh, that is so mean, where they got some quotes from some agents and from some publicists saying, oh, yeah, we don't know. You know, she's just another beautiful girl, but she really hasn't done anything to prove herself. I still had that article. And I read that article and I was demoralized, like completely broken when I read that. Because I go, yeah, you saw me play a pretty primatologist in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, but can I tell you that I want to do more? I just don't have the opportunity right now.
Right.
But I will get there. Can you not be so mean?
A man doesn't get that kind of scrutiny either when they take a role like that.
No, exactly. A man doesn't get that scrutiny. And also, there's no other career that I can think of where you're scrutinized to this level. You know, where they run an article and get quotes from other agents and publicists and other industry people to understand, is Frida Pinto going to really succeed, or is this the end of a career? And critics did that, and I read all of it, and I, you know, in the early days, I would read every article that came out right after the film was released. And it was really, really depressing sometimes. Some of them were very complimentary, like the ones around Trishna and some around Julian Schnabel's film, very, very complimentary. But they all ended up on being, and she looks so pretty, and she's this bright light, and gorgeous, beautiful skin. And it would drive me crazy, because I go, I want to do more. I'm not happy with just giving them this and just giving them that much material to say all of the things that they're saying. So it really was up to me to figure it out if I was going to push the envelope to say, actually saying no for 2 years is a very scary decision to make.
It's so hard to be a woman and to you know, have that kind of pressure and scrutiny and be seen for your outsides.
Yeah.
And then your only sort of option is to step away from the thing you love doing so that you can...
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I had to go away to reinvent. I wouldn't step away for good, but I needed to go away to reinvent and to also kind of sometimes just go with the flow, you know, just trust that your instincts are in the right place, your desires, your work that you're putting in, they're all in the right place, and something is going to click. And I think that the decision of saying no to certain film projects, just to keep myself going. You know, sometimes you just do things just because you don't want to sit idle. But I made the conscious decision of saying no and then sitting idle, which means I open myself up to intense amounts of anxiety.
I bet.
I threw myself into it.
You have to sit there.
You sit there and go, and you don't have, are they going to see me as anything else but this? But I still kept pursuing stuff that I really wanted, and I didn't give up. And I think what brilliantly happened during that time is I realized each man for his own, go create your own projects and make them happen. And so I started producing. So I wouldn't say that the 2.5 years of anxiety was a waste. I think it was brilliant. It brought me closer to some of my deeper, darker thoughts.
Yeah, you got to know yourself better, probably.
I got to know myself better. And I feel for every rise, there is a fall. And like someone said to me right at the start of my career, was it Dustin Hoffman? Peaks and valleys. That's what he said.
Yeah.
Yeah, peaks and valleys for any actor. Doesn't matter who you are.
But, you know, it's a funny thing when I think about it. It's sad that, you know, the last thing you ever want to do is somehow give off the message that you're not grateful for what you have in life, in anything, right?
Yeah.
And to be offered roles and to be thought of as beautiful and to be seen a certain way.
Yeah.
It's almost like some sort of golden cage, because inside you're going, no, I want to do more, and I'm more than this. But what I'm trying to say is, it's an ironic thing to have something that a lot of people would say is an amazing quality also be something that could stand in your way.
Yeah, I know. I see what you're saying. But I feel like for me to allow myself to go, oh, don't be ungrateful, first of all, I don't look at it as being ungrateful. I'm very grateful for all the amazing compliments that come my way when someone sends me a script where they think I can be a beautiful princess. Or
right.
I'm like, okay, yes, yes, that's beautiful. That's absolutely fantastic. But that's not how I see myself. And so I let, you know, graciously and gracefully, as much as I can, just let people know that that's not where I want to be. But yes, I am grateful for whatever it is that you're complimenting me for. But that's not the whole me. That's not the whole package that I come with. And I feel, yeah, that is something maybe later on in life. When I was first starting off, I was like you said, I couldn't afford to complain.
Right.
But about, you know, a good, like, 5-6 years into the industry, when I finally found my voice, I realized I shouldn't keep quiet and not say what I really feel like saying. And actually, I was at a convention, summit in New York 2 years ago, and Madeleine Albright was at the talk, and she said, women need to realize that when they need to say something, they need to say it right away. Because if you don't say it, someone else will say it for you. And you don't want that. And so that's when I guess, you know, I realized this is it. This is not something that I need to be quiet about. I feel it. Let me say it. Let me put it out there.
Yeah.
But let me say it in the most graceful way possible. No, thank you very much. You're very kind, but I don't want to play your princess.
That's the most empowering thing of all, to go out and get out of the lane that people are trying to put you in.
Absolutely. And I feel that should be true of not just the acting profession, but anything else, anything in life. Like, I just feel a little bit of a fight, a little bit of struggle just adds to your personality, just adds to your character, just makes you understand yourself better, just makes you just a stronger person.
Right.
So I have no problems with fighting for what I, you know, want. But obviously I'm not going to beg, but I'm definitely going to put up a good fight.
I want to talk about another decision you made, which is, I think in the United States, if you know you want to be an actor or an actress as a kid, you're probably not going to college. Or if you're going to college, you're probably going a couple of years and you're auditioning the whole time.
That was not going to happen in the Pinto household.
Tell me about that, because you didn't do anything professionally until you finished college, right?
Yeah. I, growing up in Bombay, had a lot of modeling offers, and yeah, I even spoke to my mom about it at one point, and she was like...
While you were in high school.
While I was in high school, and she said to me, you will finish your education, and then once you have something that you can fall back on, you can go ahead and do whatever it is that you want in life.
And did you know you wanted to act?
I did, but also at that point in time... there wasn't a way for me to do it specifically in India, because my parents are not from Bollywood or from the film industry. And they just did not know how to help me get my foot in the door. So I was going to be able to do it all by myself. But for that, I needed my own skill sets, education. And I enjoyed it. I think college days were the best days for me, where I really understood myself, made a lot of mistakes. And I'm actually really glad I had the ages 18 to 21 to make all the silly mistakes that I ever wanted to make. And of course, I made them in my 20s. But whether it was in drinking or other suspect material, you know, just tried it all, because I had no idea that Slumdog was going to hit me at the age of 23. And at that point in time, I had no inclination to go out there and F it up.
Right, right. Yeah. It brings up a question. Growing up in Mumbai or Bombay, was the dream Bollywood or Hollywood?
The dream was, this is a very interesting question, and I get again, a lot from the Indian media, but without making it seem like I'm ungrateful for the place that I was born and brought up in, I had no specific Hollywood or Bollywood dream. For me, it was, I just want to be part of amazing films. And actually, the only thing I know is that I want them to be international. I want everybody in the world to watch them. And actually, this is a story that my parents and I talk about quite a lot. It all came from this one woman in India who won Miss Universe that particular year, Sushmita Sen. And what I thought was amazing about her victory and her title was that the whole world at that point in time knew who Sushmita Sen was at that particular point in time, because she was on this international platform.
Unlike Bollywood,
or even like contained. Hollywood, where it's you think it's just, you know, it's... of course, we know a lot of Hollywood actors, but there's a lot of independent films that happen is that it's just America.
Sure.
So I always craved to be on an international platform.
You dreamed big.
I dreamed big. But I did not know how that was going to happen, right? It could be with a British film, which actually it was kind of with Slumdog Millionaire.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's go back a little bit because you were a model, right?
Yeah, I modeled for a bit. I hated it.
And you were auditioning.
And I was auditioning and I was a host on a travel show. So I traveled all over Southeast Asia for 9 months. I did all kinds of odd jobs. I was an entertainer at children's parties and I dressed up as these characters. Teletubby and Poison Ivy, a clown sometimes a bear, I don't even know, and anything and
really?
Everything. So I did all kinds of odd jobs.
And you were working, you were making
since
money.
Since the age of 16, yeah.
Wow. And so how did the Slumdog opportunity come around?
That was an open casting call. There was the agency that I was, a modeling agency that I was with, and every other agency in Bombay got contacted. Bombay, Delhi, I guess all over India, got contacted to say, oh, you know, Danny Boyle's making this film. And the funny thing is, my agent back then told me it was David Boyle. She says, David Boyle's making this film, and it's in the English language, and I know you're most comfortable in English, so why don't you go ahead and audition for this, and Loveleen Tandon, the casting director, will see you when you get there.
The great David Boyle.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, I'll Google David Boyle. So I'm like, David Boyle. Like, some random people came up on David Boyle on Facebook, and I was like, who the hell is David Boyle? So I land up at the audition, and I tell the casting director, Loveleen, I actually have no idea who David Boyle is. And she looks at me and she goes, okay, this is a Danny Boyle audition. And if you don't know who Danny Boyle is, this is going to be problematic. Yeah. And when she said Danny Boyle, I was like train spotting Danny Boyle. And then I was like, okay, I shouldn't have asked her this just before I started auditioning. Now I'm really nervous.
Yeah.
But anyway, I did the audition and that was a 6-month process.
A 6-month process. Yeah. You can't gloss over that. No. That's like the longest audition ever.
Yeah, it was once a month, sometimes twice a month, once a month with Danny, once a month with Loveleen, the casting director. And he was auditioning anybody and everybody, like 3,000 people, I guess, all over the world. And
like, how did it work over the 6 months? Was it a weeding down process and it got more intense with each audition?
It definitely got more intense, but it also made me progressively more obsessive with the character. To the point that I was like, now I'm 3 months into this audition. They still haven't decided whether it's going to be me or whether it's going to be someone else. And the funny thing is, you know, when you go into these auditions, sometimes your audition time overlaps with the end of someone else's audition time. And then we'd like walk next to each other and go, okay then. But anyway, I mean, I just kept going in there all the time. The problem was that Danny had to cast 3 different age groups, right?
Yeah.
So it was Dev, Madhur and I, and then there were the 3 middle kids and then the 3 youngest.
Right.
And so I think till Dev got cast, they couldn't do the pairings right properly.
Right.
I think Dev was asked for his opinion as well, which we laughed about quite a lot. I was like, oh, so you picked me, huh? But I think that was a process, so which is why it was 6 months. It just went on and on and on, and Danny just had to be convinced that I was the right one for the part.
When you hear about that, you think, like, what a great way to sort of do a character study and figure
Absolutely.
It out.
Absolutely. And also considering I had no acting experience at all, professional acting experience. I did a lot of amateur theater. But no acting experience. I think it was very important for him to know how far he could take me.
And did that cross over into sort of almost pre-directing or for the role of him sort of leading you where he wanted to go and teaching you? And
I think, yes. I think a couple of things that he said at that point in time were really, really important. Coming from an Indian culture, we're very, very animated. I am a lot less animated now, but we're
actually very calm.
I'm probably calm right now because there's only this much space to move. But we use our face quite a lot. You know, every bit of our facial expressions are a lot more
culturally.
Culturally,
mean. Oh, that's
yes.
Fascinating.
Very much, very much. It's just something that we tend to do, and we use our hands a lot, like the Italians. And so I think with Danny, what I had to do, and specifically because of his directing style as well, to really learn to internalize it and not use my eyebrows and my face and my eyes, definitely my eyes, but like not use, you know, the various things on my face to say what I'm trying to say, but just use the depth in my eyes, the sound of my voice, to really say what it is that I was trying to emote. And I think that was the six month for me, my acting workshop with Danny. That was what it was all about.
I don't think American Idol takes 6 months from start to finish. I mean, how did it feel when you finally got the call?
Oh my God. First of all, I kind of felt like by the fifth month, I got a little, big-headed about it. I was like, this is mine. I'm like the only one who's gone into all these auditions.
Really?
Like, from the beginning to the end, there are people who have dropped out.
That says something about your confidence, because I would think after 5 months, like, there's no way.
No. I was really obsessive at that point in time, like obsessed with the character. And then Lavleen had actually told me that it was, though he's seeing like 10 to 15, it's down to three people and you're part of them. And she obviously wouldn't tell me who the other two were. But I was like, okay, fine, I'm going into this next one and I'm just going to kill it. And I go in and I don't know if I killed it or not, but I just felt like I had given it my all and now this had to be mine. Somewhere it felt, I don't know if you ever have this feeling, sometimes when you're doing something, you're working on something, somewhere deep down in the pit of your stomach, you know whether it's going to be yours or not. And I just felt this is, no one knows Latika the way I know her right now. And I'm sure other actors felt the same way.
I imagine the two who were down to it that went as long as you that didn't get the call.
But they probably
must have
felt
devastated.
I know, I'm sure they were. There was a journalist who told me in the UK, there's a lot of girls who hate you right now. I was like, oh my God, that's really a strong thing to say to someone. He goes, no, they all tried for the part because they were trying the UK and US, India.
Right.
And I go, well, I'd hope they don't hate me and, you know, be happy for me because we all went for the same thing.
Exactly.
But there can be only one.
How did you get the news?
I was in my little one-bedroom flat in Bombay and in the bedroom, and I remember when I got the call on my little Nokia cell phone. I picked it up and she was like, "This is it." This is it. And she kept saying that. I was like, this is what? She goes, your first film role. It's here. And I was like, oh, my God. Because it was only Slumdog at that point in time. Nothing else that was happening. I was like,
yeah.
Oh, my God. This is it. So I just kept jumping. I was so happy, so excited that, you know, I was going to be part of this film. And then immediately I started getting really nervous because I was like, I have never been part of a film before.
Yeah. And part of a giant film. That with a very experienced director, it's not like you went on to a little independent film where everyone's finding their way.
Yeah. Now it got really nervous. I was like, I remember the first day we filmed, my first ever scene was a scene with Madhur, the boy who plays Salim, when he comes to see me.
Right.
Yeah, in Javed's home. And that was the first scene that I did. I had three lines, and I learned them a little too much to the point that I couldn't sleep that night because it just kept saying my lines over and over. I'm like, what if I forget this line?
Were you terrified that you were going to forget your line?
Totally terrified that I was going to forget three simple lines.
Really?
You know, of not being able to live up to whatever it is that they saw in the 6 months. And that was a tough one because I've never been on a film set before. I never even grew up watching what happens on a film set. You know, I never grew up in a film family.
Isn't that funny?
So it was really weird. It was a weird experience, and
you didn't know where to stand or what.
I didn't know what those markers were, and then and Anthony Don Mantel would make me look off camera and put like a patch on his arm, saying, "Look at this arm," but I'm like actually speaking to someone, but looking at his arm. Then the things that they keep saying about lights, the whole production, the magnanimity of the production with people fixing lights and everything was just absolutely fascinating. Then the words like speed, sound speed. I'm like, what speed? I'm like, I don't know what that means.
No, thank you.
No, thank you. No, I'll stay away from that. It didn't work for me. So I feel that was the experience, which I remember really well, which is just being fish out of water, not knowing what is happening, but just being so happy.
I'll tell you, I watched it two nights ago. And
oh,
the last time I saw it was in the theater when it came
out.
And the scene in the kitchen where Dev's character comes to visit you.
Yeah.
You have to portray a lot of stuff. First off, the backstory is only implied that why you're there and that you're a kept woman and that you're also in this terrible marriage.
Yeah.
And your fear for your own safety.
Yeah.
And yet you also feel something really deep for this character. And it's a really complex scene to pull off. And then when you take him over to the door to get him out of the door, there's a moment there where I would never guess in a million years that that's your first film because you draw the entire audience in on that. Did you have enough awareness as an actor back then to know that that was a big movie moment?
No, not at all.
Not at all. No, I could now so. You could identify those moments in a script, right?
And yeah,
go,
maybe.
Oh, tomorrow's a big day.
Yeah. And that's the part that I feel was so beautiful about Slumdog, because in Danny's own words, he after Slumdog was done and all the award ceremonies were done with and we won the awards, he said, "Now you're a little tarnished, you know, because you've kind of seen it all, but not in a bad way, not in a negative way." But, you know, the whole Alice in Wonderland, not knowing what is happening, being so raw, a little part of it just gets a little tainted, you know, a little tarnished. But that's okay.
I hear that, and I think that's how a father feels about a daughter.
Mm.
That there's a period in life as a kid where you just believe in the good of the world and the innocence of the world. And you get a little tarnished, and we all have to go through it.
Yeah.
But I bet for Danny, it felt like he'd discover this person.
Yeah.
And taken her into that world.
Oh, absolutely. And agents, publicists, managers, the whole works, you know,
right.
things that we didn't even need to talk about before Slumdog and during Slumdog as well. So, I think the whole, even like the whole round of going, meeting agents in the UK, in the US, and making the decision and everybody like fighting for you. I think all of that was, it's a lot to take on when you just come from nowhere.
I imagine. I mean, give me a sense of what those meetings are like. Because that's something that very few people ever go through.
There's a lot of pitching. We should put you in this role. We should put you in that role.
A lot of promising.
A lot of promising. Oh my God, a lot of promising. And luckily for me, I don't know what it is, but I already could see through what was real and what was not. And for me, the deal breaker with any of this, I had a fantastic UK meetings, like within the UK with the London agents. They were all fantastic, absolutely brilliant. But then there were ones that I felt would be right for me. And, you know, I needed someone who would get me a little more. And then when I came to the US, there were obviously more promises. And I feel like the US are a little more flamboyant with their promises. Can barely keep any of them. But I'm sorry, I have to say, I'm going to tell you the truth.
It's
Hollywood. Welcome to Hollywood. But I did, obviously, my agent, the reason why I even picked her was because she did not speak much in the meeting, which was a little scary, but she was the only one who paid attention.
Really?
She was the only one who paid attention, because every meeting that I took where I was constantly asked, so what films do you want to be in? And then obviously it was mostly the big budget films that people were throwing at me. Oh gosh, you should be the next James Bond film. You should be in the next Marvel film. And that's all great. It's absolutely amazing. But when I was asked what was my favorite film, I somehow kept, you know, mentioning Stanley Kubrick and, you know, my 80s films. And Hilda, my agent, when I had still not made my decision, she sent to my room a limited edition Stanley Kubrick archives book, and she knew that if I ever got a chance to do something brilliant, which I would after Slumdog, then that wouldn't be a big budget film. That would be to continue proving to the world that I'm not a one hit wonder.
Right.
And yeah, so she was the only one who, because obviously I knew Slumdog was so big, so massive, that could just disappear. Don't we hear those stories all the time? That could just disappear, and I could be that one girl in that big film.
That's right.
And that could be the end of it. But that's not what I wanted for myself.
Well, it's the dichotomy of, on the one hand, being able to have that first experience with a director like Danny, with a film like that, with co-stars like that. It's the best first experience to have in terms of how you expect the industry to behave on sets and the quality you expect. But on the other hand, you wouldn't be wrong for thinking maybe it's all downhill from here.
Yeah, no, I did think that for a bit. I was like, oh my God, what if this is it?
Yeah.
What if there's, which is why you'd need a team, right, to then go and suss out the best projects out there. But I never knew that you needed a team, first of all. I did not know how you form a team, how you pick a team. Like, that was all new to me. So yeah, I did think this was it. I did think this was going to be nothing else after that.
Also, I would think that the terror of the sum total of your acting experience is this one film with one director. And so you would probably assume, oh, all directors do it the same way, right?
Yes, and Danny did warn me that not every director was going to have their own style. So what I would need to have is tons of flexibility, you know, to just understand what they're asking for, but also have an understanding of what it is, how it is that I work.
Right.
And be able to have that marriage, that dance between the director-actor. That obviously was only going to come with experience. It wasn't going to magically be something that I would just gain because I had never been to an acting school. But yeah, he absolutely did warn me about it. And every director I've worked with, no two directors have been alike.
Yeah.
So it's just, I think the ones that were more hands-off were more difficult for me to deal with.
Really?
Woody Allen,
a situation
Michael
like
Winterbottom.
Woody Allen. Because you're not getting enough feedback to know
because
how you're doing.
Because I'm not getting feedback, yes. And I'm like constantly waiting for them to, you know, with Danny, we'd do tons of takes. Just even though he had it, we just liked playing with it. Just seeing where else it can go.
Right.
And that's beautiful, you know, for an actor. That's amazing to be, especially a film and TV actor. You don't really get that in theater except for the months of rehearsals that you do before that.
I have to say, I think the choices you've made, however they've worked out box office wise or you know, in the case of Woody Allen, I feel like you were underwritten in that film. But I think to take on a process like that still relatively early in your film career must have been terrifying.
Yeah, terrifying and exciting at the same time, because I had to, you know, just remind myself that I am in this is a kind of career, and I'm not saying this, I don't mean this in a boastful way at all. The kind of career that I've managed to build in the last 8 years, a lot of actors don't build that in 8 years. They take a lot longer to work with directors of that caliber, especially coming out of nowhere without a godfather in the industry or without that acting school experience or a mentor. You know, I really came out from nowhere. So I'm really grateful for each and every experience. And like you said, the box office doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, in like 20 years, when I look back at my career, I know I've worked and I've learned, not just worked, but also learned from directors like Michael Winterbottom, Woody Allen, Julian Schnabel. I will know that I actually went to the best acting school ever.
But is the lesson also sometimes that the best ones don't quite know until they, you know, like the best ones experiment?
Terrence Malick.
Okay, so let's talk about
that.
I don't
know what we were doing.
You did Knight of Cups, and I read something you said about this film, which is that there's a freeing feeling to not having any boundaries. But I would also think that would be potentially dangerous as an actor to not have boundaries. But you took away, I mean, I was impressed that you took a feeling away that it was the most freeing experience.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to do every film like that. You know,
right.
I don't want to do every film without knowing where I'm going, without there are script writers for a reason, you know.
Of course.
There are professional script writers who study for years the art of script writing and putting a story together, creating character arcs. So yes, that is an experience that I'm so grateful to have once or twice in my career, but obviously I'm not going to do every film like that. But because I do the scripted way as well, once in a while, it's kind of nice to just break free and not be bothered about the whole acting of it all. The just being of it all was really what the Terrence Malick film was all about. And I think with the Terrence Malick film, it goes beyond acting. There's a concept of surrender the concept of surrender is what you really understand in a Terrence Malick film, because you don't know what he is going to use at the end of the day, but you just go, I'm just going to give it everything, because whatever he wants, he'll take.
Right.
And it's a surrender, because most actors don't want to go whatever, you know, he can take just what he wants. They want, take everything, put me in the film, put me properly in the film, you know, do me justice. So, and there's that concept of surrender that I really did understand, which I can extrapolate and use in other performances, but not at the cost of not being in the film at the end of it. Because that happens in a Terrence Malick film a lot. Luckily not with me, but it has happened with a lot of actors.
But I would think that process would really force you to look at yourself, like to look at your insecurities, to look at your relationship with self-criticism.
Yeah.
Like, did you go through a process with that where it sort of made you examine the larger profession or your relationship to acting?
I think because of the story of the film as well, it was all based on Los Angeles and Hollywood and the concept of concept of validation. Yeah. You know, everybody wants to be validated. Everybody wants to be accepted and praised. And with this particular one, we had to let go of all of that because you were not going to get validated at the end of a scene. And you just surrender. You just go, I just do it. And oh, that is my insecurity that I constantly look at the director going, was that good? And then he doesn't say anything. I did have that experience with Woody Allen and Michael Winterbottom. So I feel the Terrence Malick film was much easier in that sense because I did not need that constant validation from him. Interestingly, actually, Terry came up to me in one of the scenes and he said to me, you don't strike me as one of the people who seeks constant validation. And I looked at him and said, do you know what I do for a living? I always seek validation. I want people to like my performances, like my movies, watch my movies. And he goes, okay, for the next couple of minutes, just think of what life would be like if you didn't need validation. And then he starts rolling the camera. And while I'm in that, he's put me in this thought process. He's actually filming anything and everything that I'm saying in that moment, because I don't care about what Christian Bale's character says to me at that point in time, because I don't want his validation.
You don't need anything from him.
I don't need anything from him.
Right.
And that was a scene that he ended up using in the film where, you know, he's talking to me and I'm just going, looking at him, smiling, going, I'm just saying whatever it is that I want to say, but it doesn't matter. I don't care if you think of me as beautiful or someone you want to love, someone you don't want to love, someone you want to hate. It really doesn't matter. And I just realized at that point in time, that was such an interesting exercise, and that, which is why I say it goes beyond acting.
Yeah.
You know, it was such an interesting exercise just for life, to just think about life for a minute of life without validation, which is crazy, right? Because look at Instagram.
Yeah.
It's all about validation.
Exactly.
It's all about like me, like me, like me, like me.
And quantifiable.
It's not the best. Social media is not the best for an artist. Definitely not for an actor. I can tell you that much. It's as this is plainly my opinion, but I don't think it's healthy. Not at all healthy.
And it can be distracting.
Distracting, destroying. It can be destructive as well. If you constantly look on social media for what people actually thought about you and your performance and get extremely happy when they like you and then they get really sad when they don't like you. And, you know, you're constantly flitting between these distractions rather than just focusing on what is most important at that point in time.
Right.
So for me, that was not what I got into acting for. And not for any of that. Of course, I want people to watch my films, but I then think about old school filmmaking where it was all about just a great performance, connecting with your co-stars, connecting with your director, having this beautiful relationship with people on set and just telling this beautiful human story.
Well, God, it hasn't been that long from Slumdog till now.
Yeah.
And you've carved out this very unpredictable career. And at the same time, you're really honest about some of the things that you felt like you sort of had to do to get where you are and some of the things that didn't turn out the way you wanted them to. I think that's a really honest approach. And judging by the work you're doing now, I'm impressed by your your path and the way you're taking it, because it could be demoralizing to just be seen for your surface.
Mm-hmm.
And even, I would say, you know, that indelible frame on Slumdog where you're seen from above on the train platform. Because Danny created something really special with that film.
He did, and there was a line in it that that Dev's character, that Jamal says, she's the most beautiful girl in the world. And I go, oh my God, that line is going to be my blessing and my curse.
That's not going to help you get a militant gorilla part.
Not at all.
It's going to be your blessing and your curse. Yeah. I think, and I think that to do what you've done and to figure it out that's not easy. I think a lot of people could fall into that trap, you know.
But I do feel really lucky and blessed to have always surrounded myself with the right people. You know, that I believe is my gift, that I go through these phases where I know I work with some people and then I go, I don't want to work with you because you don't help me go forward. So let's just break up, but let's do it amicably and let's move on. So yeah, for me, I think it's that is the one gift that I am really, really happy I had from the get-go, to pick and choose the people that I want to work with and the right team to create around me, to support me in everything that I do.
Well, thank you for telling me your story and
you.
For kind of enlightening me on because I think that when you see someone from afar and you watch their work, you don't quite know what the thought process behind it.
Yeah.
And now that I know you, I feel like I just respect you even more.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation, and you should really check out Gorilla, which is Frida's new show on Showtime. It's a 6-part series, and it's really compelling and great filmmaking, so check that out. And when you're done with that, go check out offcamera.com. And if you haven't subscribed yet, you should, because we send out an email every week telling you what's going on in the off-camera world. Also, check out our store. It's a great way to support the show. We make a limited edition magazine for each guest, and they really are collector's items, and it's a great way to get more into the show. So check out the magazine, check out the store, and most of all, tell your friends about Off Camera. You know, we're a small operation. We don't have a big marketing or advertising budget. It's really a labor of love around here to bring you this show each week. So spread the word. Don't keep it a secret. I want to thank everyone that helped on the show this week. We have Nate Shields, our Wizard of Sound, Michaela Galvin, our visual arts and camera operator, Crawford Shippey, our producer, wrangler, and head of adult supervision, Laura Kemper, who keeps the whole place running and hopefully locks the doors at night, Amy Jones, who does research and writing and keeps us all entertained with her wit, Matt Davidson, who cleans the toilets, and Kara Johnson, our transcriptionist, who takes everything we say into this white room and makes it make sense, and Justin Kennedy, who manages to help us be lint-free and stylish, and you all, the listeners, for tuning in each week and for supporting the show. Thanks a lot, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with comedian and actor Matt Walsh.
As a little kid, I always knew jokes. The minute somebody told me a joke, I remembered it. I just had a natural inclination to remember comedy and jokes, and I always cared about it. I think I understood that you want to attack those things that you as a person find hypocritical or not true but are accepted as true. I always had this, like, push to try something different than what was accepted without knowing what I was doing.
You probably know him as Veep's press secretary, Mike McClintock. But improv and sketch comics everywhere revere him as the co-founder of Upright Citizens Brigade, the world's most famous sketch and improv theater. He talks about the struggle of his early days and why his current success will never beat the thrill of working a stage without a net. Oh, and you'll meet his mom. So make sure to tune in. See you next time, off camera.